The MCC sounds like in today's pop culture, it rings a bell. You'll have to tell me why.
Did you check to see if he had a handcuff key hidden anywhere? I've had defendants who literally had them in their mouth. Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor. Jim, I am so excited because coming back for part two, we get to dive back in to the case files of one Jim Fitzgerald. Hi, Fitz.
Hey, Francie. Hey, Jim. Great to be back with you guys.
Hey, Fitz, how you doing?
Fitz, we're so excited to have you on. And I know you're not good at bragging about yourself. Unlike me and Jim, we're great at bragging about ourselves.
So
actually, Jim's great at bragging about himself. Anyway,
please.
I mean, Jim puts like 18 things at the front of his, hi, I'm Jim Clemente. I've conquered the world. There's nothing left for me. Something like that.
I don't know if there's nothing that you did that is interesting enough to actually.
Well, that might be true. But the same is not true for Jim Fitzgerald, who, I mean, Fitz, your career, well, can I just say, it reads like a book. I mean, I know you've written books.
Or three.
That's just one of your careers. He's on number four. But you started off as a child detective. I'm pretty sure that should be a TV show, Doogie Howser Mysteries or something. And then you went on to become a store detective where you faced, you know, shoplifters potentially attacking you. And then you went on to the Ben Salem PD, which seems like it would have been a Sleepy Town, Andy Griffith Mayberry sort of thing, but definitely not. And then you went on to the FBI where, sadly, you were partnered often with one James Clemente. I don't know how you dealt with that. And then the two of you became profilers.
Of his life and career.
Yeah, whatever. And then the two of you became profilers together. And then what people don't know is that after you retired, you wrote books based on your career, and they're called Journey to the Center of the Mind. And in your career, you caught the Unabomber all by yourself, or at least that's what I heard.
Please, Francie.
Well, it depends what book you read or what miniseries you watch, but mostly true. And no, the Unabomber arrest was a team effort, but everything else you got pretty much right. Yeah, I want to make, you know, Ben Salem, PA is a very busy suburb of Philly. It's not Mayberry. I mean, I-95 went through it, the PA Turnpike, there's racetracks, Route 1 cut through it. So we were a pretty busy town, catching a lot of the crime that came north out of Philly and other parts. So, but everything else, you pretty much hit on the money there, including my lifelong friendship with Jim C, as we used to, when we were part of the gyms.
I don't think I said lifelong friendship. I'm pretty sure I said it was something that you had to endure.
Yeah, well, you really know how to misinterpret things. Anyway, Fitz, it's great to have you back, and we can't wait to dive back into the story. So you're waiting outside of this international killer hitman's apartment where he's hiding out for 2 years after escaping from prison. What happens next?
We basically surrounded this guy's door. We had people in chase cars. We assumed he would be armed, even going out lighting up for a cigar. And sure enough, at 8:30, the door opens. Here comes this guy, stands outside, walks a little bit away from his door. And that is when everybody rushed in at once. We made sure to get him on the ground. He looked around. He definitely thought about escaping, especially with this guy's known background. And he kind of looked around, hands up. And you could tell he was really thinking over the next 30 seconds or so which way to go. Finally, he went down on his knees, laid prone on the ground. We slowly went over, put the cuffs on him. I didn't. It was one of the U.S. Marshals. It was really their takedown. And we all had our guns out until that time. We put them away. And sure enough, by checking his belt area, there was a 25 caliber weapon found on him. The arrest itself was very undramatic, but you know what that means, Jim? Because you've been on undramatic arrest. It means we planned it right.
Right. Overwhelming force, looking at all the contingencies, being ready for anything that could happen, and making the person believe that there's no reason to resist or try to escape.
inner perimeter, outer perimeter, all those things we covered. So he knows he's in a secure, he knows how the arrest went down with the marshals and Ben Salem PD. Now he's in this holding cell. And the marshals want to take him to New York City from where he escaped and put him in the MCC, the Manhattan Correctional Center. And that is their goal. And so we babysat him all night. I'm practicing these Grice cooperative principles with him, not giving him any more than he asked. I don't have to answer anything with this guy, but I'm still trying to be polite. Hey, maybe he'll confess something to me. That would be kind of cool that the international hitman confesses to me just sitting outside of his cell.
Right.
Okay, Fitz. So you've described how Errico paused for about 30 seconds, obviously deciding whether he's going to fight or flight, but then goes down to his knees and the marshals put the cuffs on. What happens to him then? What do you guys do?
Well, at that point, we're not concerned about radio silence. So we bring in a patrol car, actually a van, and they put, he had his handcuffs on already. They put ankle cuffs on him, ankle bracelets, we call them. And so he couldn't run or fight. And of course, hands behind his back. A lot of police officers will make that mistake, but we made sure hands behind the back. His 25, of course, was taken out of his waistband. And they transport him back with two cars in front, two cars in back, lights and sirens to make sure no interference, no ram car is anywhere.
But Fitz, did you check to see if he had a handcuff key hidden anywhere? I've had defendants who literally had them in their mouth. It was the bottom of their gum was actually indented because it had been in there so long that you didn't even feel it if you rubbed on the outside of their cheek. Or, you know, in the belt line, in the belt hoop, somewhere behind his back where he would anticipate having his hands handcuffed.
Yeah, I think the marshals actually had a specialist with them. And out there in the parking lot of this Brookwood apartment complex, street in Humeville Roads in Ben Salem, they had a guy, it didn't quite do a body cavity search, but every piece of his clothing was squeezed, flashlights in the mouth, bent over at least and look in certain areas. And they had like people standing around so the little kids weren't walking by and seeing this. But they made sure this guy, number one, had no weapons, and number two, did not have anything like a handcuff key. And he did have a body cavity search, not by me, but by the marshals or someone when they got him back to the PD detention center, and he was covered there. But yeah, we didn't want the plan getting ruined. All right, we made the arrest successfully. He's on the ground. He's cuffed. Let's not blow it now either. And things could happen badly then too after an arrest. But the procession was only about a mile long to get from the complex to the PD. And he was walked in basically through a gauntlet to make sure nobody could come out of nowhere and somehow grab him, take him away, whatever. And we got him in the cell, and he didn't leave there until the next morning. The marshals showed up and they had a few cars with them. He was in the middle and they went up the Jersey Turnpike, the 2-hour ride. And I happen to know there was no issues getting him into the MCC safely. We just wanted to make sure we took him down safely. And for holding him overnight, we wanted to make sure he didn't escape from our detention cells in the police department. And I was in charge of supervising that whole detail to make sure we had a closed circuit TV. Remember, this is the early 80s. These police departments weren't wired up in the cars and the officers didn't have their body cams. So sometimes we had to move like cameras around if we had a high profile prisoner or someone who we thought was going to try to hurt themselves or someone else conceivably. So not only did we put a camera on this guy, but the Chief Viola told me, Fitz, I want you to actually sit in an office chair, wheel it in right outside his cell. I want you and a few of your men not taking your eyes off him at any time whatsoever.
So you're babysitting the exterminator, which is pretty incredible, in small town Pennsylvania. And the guy is at least a suspect, a named suspect, in the death of people in Italy involved with the mysterious Pope who might have, well, who let's just say died under mysterious circumstances, potentially back in 1978. And there you are, a sergeant in Ben Salem PD sitting outside this guy's cell. I mean, what was that like? This is an international criminal. I mean, this seems pretty incredible.
Sounds like Mission Impossible to me.
Yeah.
And let me just add, when they searched this, I knew this because the search of the apartment took place right afterwards. And they found four revolvers, an automatic rifle with a tripod, a sawed-off shotgun, a fully automatic machine gun, bunch of ammo, two bulletproof vests, and a hand grenade.
Oh, Fitz, that guy was loaded for bear, like literally.
And they found dye-marked money from a few bank robberies that had occurred in neighboring towns to Ben Salem.
Wow, so that's how he was supporting himself while he was living on the lam?
Yep.
Wow.
Wow, this guy's quite a character.
Besides killing bugs and other humans, he also knew how to rob banks.
Well, so Fitz, so there you are. So tell us the setup. Describe it for us. What does this jail cell look like?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't all that sophisticated, but our chief just said he's a known killer. He kills cops. He kills lawyers and banking people. Who knows where he was the night that Pope John Paul I, you know, was found dead. And I'm not directly tying him to that, but I mean, who knows? And now I'm in charge of just watching this guy and having guys working, you know, under me do the same thing. And now I want to bring in a little linguistic aspect to things. I know your listeners like hearing that stuff.
They love it.
And I didn't even know this was really linguistic stuff back then, because here I'm at the same time now, early 80s, I'm working on my first master's degree at Villanova University in organizational psychology. And just a week or two before, I had a philosophy course there, and one of the professors brought up a guy named Herbert Grice. And Grice is known for his cooperative principle. And what I didn't realize is, you know, two decades later, linguists are really into this guy, Grice, and his cooperative principle in how people communicate. But Grice's cooperative principle, just let me throw this by here. It's basically, the basic definition is, it's a cooperation between speakers and people spoken to. So right now I'm the speaker and you're being spoken to. Now we reverse roles here and you do the same back to me. I'm also the expressor, you're the receptor. But the four maxims of the cooperative principle is how people are basically innately designed to communicate to get their points across. And they are quality, quantity, relevancy, and manner. And basically quality is you don't tell falsehoods, you don't lie. This is the cooperative principle we should all have. Quantity, you don't tell more, you don't tell less. Now, I'm kind of telling a story, so I'm adding a little more.
Very Fitz of you.
Very Fitz of you. That's my new favorite adjective, Jim.
Relevancy, nothing irrelevant, and I'm trying to keep everything here relevant to the story. And lastly is manner, that is brief, orderly, avoid obscurity or ambiguity.
What about, I would think manner would also include just bowling ahead and trying to dominate the conversation, like Jim always does with me on this podcast.
Wait, what are you talking about?
Everyone knows it.
About manners. It's talking about manner, the way in which something is conveyed.
Oh, well, that's what I'm talking about, in which Jim conveys his constant superiority over me. I hear it every episode.
Some truths just are hard to avoid. That's all I can say. But let's get back to Fitz, since he is our guest and this is manners, okay?
Right, good point.
And we're talking about manners. Anyway, Fitz, so you're sitting outside of a cell, not in the cell, I hope.
No.
Okay, you're sitting outside the cell of a Mission Impossible world-renowned killer, exterminator, and he wants to talk to you. He's asking you about you. Do you think maybe he thinks you're some kind of country bumpkin he's going to manipulate into letting him out?
Yeah, and remember, this guy's already killed. He got a $100,000 contract to kill a lawyer and a finance person in Italy. He also killed another contract for the Palermo, Italy, police chief Boris Giuliani, because there were other documents that he found. And now all of a sudden, I'm sitting across from this guy, and he's trying to make friendly with me. And I'm going back to these Herbert Grice principles of cooperation, of how people talk, how people communicate with one another. And as I mentioned, quality, quantity, relevancy, and manner. And I'm trying to be polite to this guy and at the same time not give him any information in which he could possibly track me down or find out where I live. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not afraid of this guy. I'm not like sitting there trembling in my shoes. I'm a law enforcement professional. It's my job to arrest people like this, and we did it right.
What does he say? What is he asking you?
First thing he said to me is he called me kid, because I was not even 30 yet. And I did correct him. I said, that's Sergeant Fitzgerald. And I thought, why did I give him my name? I didn't want to be called kid either. Even if you're an international hitman, show me some. And he said, oh, sorry, Sergeant Fitzgerald. I never told him my first name. So how long have you been here? And for every question he asked, I waited like 30 seconds to answer. And I'm thinking of the cooperative principle. I don't want to piss him off, not because he's going to hurt me. There's jail cell, you know, bars in between us. But I just don't want this guy yelling and screaming or anything like that. I don't know him well enough. So it's just like, yeah, I, at that time, yeah, 6 years. Oh, and you're a sergeant already? And, you know, we go into this thing. Yes. And you're both, Francie and Jim are lawyers, you know, when you're cross-examining someone or even under direct, you know, the witnesses usually just answer the question asked. Yes, no, don't volunteer anything, which really falls into Grice's cooperative principle. I mean, lawyers have been using that for years. He just sort of qualified it. And here's what I was doing with this guy, thinking of this, these sort of philosophical, but certainly language and communication, you know, aspects. And here I am kind of following those same rules, thanks to this professor who happened to teach these just a week earlier. Then he goes on and on. He's asking me, did I grow up in Philadelphia? Do I live here full time? And do I want to move on and do any other job? And then he asked me, at some point, this is like maybe the second hour, have I ever been to Italy? And at that time I had not. And I probably wouldn't have told him if I had been there. Looking back, I wish I said, yeah, I was there once. I visited Pope John Paul I. Do you happen to know him? See if I get a confession out of it.
But Fitz, do you think he was just trying to pass the time, or do you think he was mining for information that he could then exploit to try to see if he can manipulate you into giving him just the slightest bit of advantage or even distracting you?
Yeah, was he profiling you? I mean, that's what I'm thinking, Jim. Was he profiling you, Fitz?
He definitely was, and I wasn't allowing him to do that. I could have just shut up and not said a word. No one feels comfortable doing that. Like, it's, you know, I'll show you. I won't even answer you. But I think this guy, his track record is he's all about planning. He's all about pre-operational techniques. His whole life just got turned around, like literally 2.5 hours before I'm sitting outside of his cell. He was out for 2 years from Rikers, robbing banks. We think maybe killing people. We had a homicide like a month before in Bensalem. To this day, it's not solved. We thought maybe he's connected, but we put him somewhere else. He wasn't involved in that. So he's feeling me out. I'm kind of feeling him out. I'm still a relatively young person, and certainly even in law enforcement was 6 years. And I think this was the first either domestic or international hitman I was ever sitting across from. Because I've told this, I do podcasts, interviews. There aren't that many real hitmen out there. Hollywood glorifies them and you hear about them every once in a while. But you get some local yokel, hey, I'll give you $100 if you kill my wife. And they'll go and do that. And they call themselves a hitman. Sometimes it's the wife, of course, paying to get the husband killed. And luckily, the police intercept these people in more cases than not, and they get away.
They ever kill, like,
I was just going to say, do podcasting partners ever take out hits on each other? I'm just wondering. I'm just asking for posterity.
I know. I'm just
curious.
And I have. I mean,
yeah, we both have the same question, Jim.
Question. It is weird, Francie. I wonder who you're talking about.
I don't know. It just occurred to me. I think I was reading your mind.
I hope your husband is not within earshot. I hope that.
Oh, he's not home. When I talk about hitmen, I make sure he's never here.
Okay, great.
Anyway, you said something that really kind of rung a bell for me a minute ago, and I have two questions about it. You said that the marshals wanted to take the exterminator to the MCC in Manhattan. And I have two questions. One, the MCC sounds like in today's pop culture, it rings a bell. You'll have to tell me why that rings a bell. And then secondly, why didn't they? Why did they leave him with you? Why didn't they? It's not that far, is it, from Bensalem to Manhattan?
No, it's about believe me, I know very well. I drove it for 7 years. It's about a 2-hour drive. And for intake and admin type of reasoning, they wanted to just not take him at nighttime, risk anything in the dark with any co-conspirators of his conceivably. They wanted to do it in daylight. And plus, it's easier to put someone in there in a place like the MCC during the daytime. I think they had to get him arraigned up there somehow. So for court purposes. So the bottom line was they were going to pick him up around 7 a.m. and take him up to Manhattan and basically, you know, the Bensalem PD And me and my men would be done with this operation for this evening.
And the MCC, why do we know that today?
Well, because back in August of 2000, actually, I guess it was July of 2019, Jeffrey Epstein was there, and he wound up killing himself. That's what everybody seems to,
so to speak,
think and say. At least official reports suggest that. And this was the same cell, the same prison, of course, the same detention center that William Errico was being taken to early that morning of June 17th in 1982. So when I did a news segment in August of 19, this case came to mind. And I said, you know what? I have a connection with the MCC. And not only did they allow Jeffrey Epstein to kill himself a month ago, but in 1984, they let an international hitman get out the window and climb about 50 feet down the side of the building. Yes.
Wait a minute.
William Errico.
What?
What?
Jim, I'm speechless.
No bars? I mean, I know that building. There are very few windows in the whole damn building. But how did that happen, Fitz?
He and one of his colleagues from the whole Italian affair and the Pope and the Vatican Bank and killing bankers and police chiefs, another guy was there named Michel Sindonia, and they both somehow got sheets, just like the old movies. They made it out of their cell, and they made it to an open window, and they dropped the sheets out, tied together. You can picture the knots in them every, 10 feet or so. But they had a little problem with math. And I guess you could throw physics in there, too, because the sheet collection was not quite long enough to reach the next roof, which was about 40 feet in distance. And when they both dropped, they both hit the ground, the concrete, and they died.
Wait a minute. Okay, hold on. Back up. First of all, I don't understand. I mean, I always thought that this tying sheets together was a bunch of TV garbage. I don't understand how people can collect enough sheets to tie together with nobody paying any attention to it to get out of their cell and get to a window in the first place. And in the second place, this guy is an international murderer, fugitive, who'd already escaped from Rikers Island. How were they not watching him at MCC? And now suddenly I'm understanding how Epstein was allowed to kill himself.
Well, now you see the link, four decades apart between the MCC and allowing someone to collect at least one sheet with Epstein and kill himself with that, hang himself with that. And somehow with Errico back in the mid 80s, doing the same thing, except collecting sheets, not trying to kill himself, but get out an open window, believe it or not. And both at the MCC, I'm sure there were different people working on each shift and in charge of the facility at that time. But the point is, separated by several decades, we have two very lax administrations, employees, correctional officers, whatever you want to call them, CCTV systems, whatever you want to attest to it. And they both failed. To this day, I'm not sure what Epstein, if it was suicide, if it was homicide. I don't have any direct information of that, but it's pretty clear I knew everything Errico did. Certainly that was public and made available back in Italy, in Bucks County, PA. And then a few years later, when he finally went, did his final trip out the window and hit the ground hard.
All right. Well, we know at least one thing then, that Errico didn't kill Jeffrey Epstein.
I think we can rule that out at this point, Jim.
Which one of you have ever been in the MCC? I find the whole idea that Errico was able to tie sheets together and get out the window to be baffling, because normally these federal facilities, which they have to be federal facilities to hold federal prisoners, although they're usually state facilities with certain number of federal cells, but they have to meet certain requirements and standards. What does the MCC look like? I mean, is it just easy to escape?
Well, I've been down there a few times, but just mainly to drop off and pick up prisoners. I haven't actually been to the cells themselves, but I can tell you that it's very officially and professionally run, although we all know some pretty major examples of when that professionalism kind of failed. The Epstein case is a perfect example, but I don't know. Fitz, have you been there? Have you seen, actually been back to the cells there at MCC?
I have. And in one of our earlier shows, I talked about the bank robber who turned informant, about the mob guys who were going to kill the son of a federal judge. So right. We had to wire that guy up. And I was inside the holding area. And I did have a picture of what the cell blocks looked like, whatever. And of course, it looks like a very secure lockup facility. No one's sent there for a real long time. They're basically awaiting trial in that place or transportation one place to another. And that's what was happening with Errico. He was possibly even being sent back to Italy in some sort of an extradition. That was the plan. So these escapes don't usually happen, you know, at nighttime when all the administrators are there, when maybe officers or agents like me and Jim are going in and out. But these things happen usually at nighttime, maybe in the very morning hours when trash trucks, whatever, are going in and out, there's noise created. So to answer your question, Francie, it looks like a very secure place. They don't escape from there very often, but at least in the mid-80s, there was one good attempt with Mr. Errico, a.k.a. Exterminator, and he could have been out killing more people if he didn't have that final drop of about 40 feet or so.
Well, Fitz, do you know if they were both on the sheets at the same time? Or if they just did it one at a time, did it tear? And that's why they ended up crashing to the ground?
You know, this is it's all in a book called In God's Name. It's a 1985 book by David Wallop. And the subtitle is An Investigation into the Murder of Pope John Paul I. Now, you guys know me. I'm not a big conspiracy person. I'm not sure if he was murdered or not. But boy, there's some people around the whole banking system that were murdered. And who are about to testify in court. So, but in terms of the exact specifics of that escape attempt, I'm told it was Sheets. I'm told two people went out at the same time or close to the same time. And apparently they tested the sheets for weight, that if each guy was, 200 pounds, it could hold 400, whatever. But that didn't seem to be the problem. It seems they ran out of sheet, which of course is always a problem if you're climbing down the side of a tall building and they couldn't convert them to parachutes or anything like that. So they wound up dropping to the floor and to the ground. And their hitman career was then ended.
Well, you know, it's funny because you feel like you've got hitmen who's so sophisticated. The Exterminator, he's got a name. He's, intrigue, international guy. He's got grenades and automatic weapons. And yet he's so dumb that he dies because he doesn't tie enough sheets during his escape. What an idiot.
Well, Francie, they probably couldn't get access to enough sheets, but he did certainly hit the ground, and that's appropriate for a hitman, I suppose. The fact is, though, that you were not able to then actually ever fully debrief him, right? Nobody actually knows everything he did. It went to the grave with him.
Yeah, without a doubt. And there's no doubt there are crimes unsolved because of his death. But the way I looked at it, and I ended that chapter in the book, there are probably people, many people perhaps still alive because he self-exterminated at the very end there on the way down the prison wall. So there's two ways of looking at that.
That's a good one.
So Fitz, a couple times you've mentioned your books, and I know that you've published three already. They're a continuing saga of your life, and you're working on your fourth. That's a lot of writing, and it's a lot of work, because I've done one book, and I know how many years it took me to actually put that together. How do you do all that?
Well, you say one book, Jim, but how many dozens of scripts have you written and treatments, whatever? So we're probably just about equal in that regard. Yeah, I spent 5 years pretty much devoted, besides doing consulting work and other TV work, some with you, to writing these books. I wanted to get my story out. And the middle book falls into what we were kind of talking about with the Exterminator and William Errico, my Ben Salem police days. And it actually dovetails onto an episode I did with you guys a few years ago when I was a Ben Salem sergeant. In fact, this was a few nights after the hitman arrest where I caught a Roman Catholic priest in the process of sexually assaulting not one, but two boys. So we talked about this already. We put it all on one of your episodes, and a very, you know, sad thing, but I'm glad we got this guy off the streets, whatever. But yeah, it's just best case, worst case. We talked about this priest arrest in an earlier episode of your show. I thought, well, here's a little follow up to it. Not the case itself, but just how people can be. Well, let's say their sheets, they would also go out of the side of a building with sheets too short, most likely. The weird part is I published my second book and it goes out there and I recount that story. And about 3 years, maybe 2 years after that, I read some comments under the Amazon section where it's sold. I don't even check the comments very often. But here, a present existing Ben Salem police officer, who is the son of a police officer who I reference in my book, too, in the 80s. So I wrote some things about them, all true, all accurate, all I can back up with legal documents, news articles. And here this son of this one officer decides to put some comments, and he names himself. Hey, my dad, officer, you know, retired David Klee, you stole from him. You didn't make that priest arrest. He did. And I'm reading this saying, what? And look what I have here. And he puts some kind of an attachment on the comment from some unnamed newspaper where it does say Officer David Klee made the arrest of, you know, father so-and-so, and he was then sentenced to, you know, this is like a few months later. And I'm saying, that makes no sense. It didn't happen. So I actually called up another detective, said, this is so ridiculous. Was Officer Dave Klee involved in the arrest of the priest? No. And then I called the police department nowadays, said, can you check the arrest book from 1982, June? I gave the date. You see this guy's name? Yes. Whose name is next to an arresting officer? Took him a few days to do all this. Sergeant James Fitzgerald. Any other names? No. Thank you. Now, I didn't need that, but I wanted to see if somebody was sophisticated enough to actually go in
and false information
change some records around. And certainly, at least as of a year ago, that didn't happen. So this is what happens when you write books. Jim, I know you went through some of it.
Yeah.
And even not even about your book as much as about some other stances you were taking. So it's more of a fun thing to me. We talk about best cases on this show and worst cases. Well, I still stand by. That was one of the better cases of my career, to make that arrest of that priest, get him off the streets, at least for a while. But it kind of turns into a worst case and some other officer with whom I used to work now trying to take credit for it. So it's just a funny little aside. We talk about all the interesting things I did in my career, Jim, you and Francie, same thing. But there are people out there that just want to take shots at you, just want to take take something away from you that you know you earned.
You can't focus on that. And and what I found is, you know, it's kind of fun to just throw back the truth at them and laugh at them and say, yeah, go away, have fun, you know, be a jerk if you want somewhere else. But, you know, there are people like that. I just, in fact, I think today or yesterday on Twitter, you know, some goofballs trying to attack me, you know, about my testimony, my proposed testimony in the Michael Jackson case, and, you know, saying that they ended up not calling me because I wasn't a professional or something goofy like that. But I mean, the reason why I couldn't testify was because I was actually having a bone marrow transplant at the time. And, you know, for some heckler, some, you know, goofball who, yeah, doesn't even put their identity on Twitter and thinks that they can just attack people randomly. I mean, it's just goofy, childish bullshit. And I'm sorry that you had to go through it too.
Yeah, Fitz, it's, you know, it's these trolls. I think it's a great name for them. Twitter trolls or comment trolls or whatever. At least you guys get trolled about your professional career. Whenever I appear on the news, not whenever, but sometimes when I appear, I get trolled about my looks. At least you guys don't face that. I get negative comments about, of all things, well, not just whether or not I'm particularly shapely, but also my eyebrows. Can you guys believe that? Has anyone ever commented on your eyebrows? I get actual comments about
my
eyebrows.
I actually have gotten comments. But
that's insane. Who's staring at my eyebrows, I'd like to know. And can I just say, for the record, these are my real eyebrows. So I just want to put that out there.
Yeah, no place for body shaming. And yeah, these people that really, at least in my case, I call them trolls, but they actually name the guy, the officer names himself and his father, and just trying to grab onto some kind of legacy that I guess is not there. So yeah, but again, it's more fun. I put some snarky comments back too. People want to check it out. So, but I've given up on that. So,
all right. Well, Fitz, always a pleasure to have you here, and your cases and stories are always so interesting. And we know that there will be more Jim Fitzgerald stories to come in the future on Best Case, Worst Case. But till next time, thank you for coming. To everybody else, thank you for listening to Best Case, Worst Case. Signing off.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production produced by Francie Hakes, Josh Murphy, and Jim Clementi at Empire Studios LA. Engineered and edited by Matt Gergel. Music composed and performed by Simba Sumba and hosted by Wonder.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness to Light can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's D2L.org.